I'll call the meeting to order of March 3rd, and Representative Anderson, we have a quorum. Good, so Representative Anderson, could you move the minutes, please?
I will, Madam Chair, thank you.
Representative Anderson moves the minutes of March 2nd. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. And we have Representative Morgan in place and on time, unlike the chair, so I'm glad that you are ready. Representative Morgan, could you move your bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm ready now. I'd like to move House File 2751 for possible inclusion in the K-12 Education Finance Omnibus Bill.
Representative Morgan moves House File 2751 for possible inclusion. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, that I would like to move at this point.
Representative Morgan moves the A1 amendment. Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, at the K-12 Policy Committee, there was discussion about the fact that the bill was too open and too costly, and some of you may see the fiscal note in your packet addressing the original form of the bill as introduced. I had indicated at that meeting that we would be working with MDE on a compromise. I don't think we've arrived at that compromise yet, but I think this amendment significantly tightens the scope and therefore the cost of the bill, and it will limit students to have the option to retake a paper and pencil test to one time in December of their junior year, one time in December of their senior year, and then once in July if they have still not passed it after their graduating class graduates.
Any questions on the amendment? All in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my school district came to me. The assistant principal at my school came to me last fall when I was working there, and he expressed some concerns about students who were continually failing the computer version of the grad test in reading and language arts. And he asked if there was some way we could go about making sure that they'd have the opportunity to take a paper and pencil test. I told him, I had some suggestions to him to how he could get this moving, and he did, and the bill before you, as amended, is our best effort at this point to do that. And I have with me not only my assistant principal and my superintendent, but also Mr. Mose from the St. Paul School District. I would like to start the testimony with Mr. Mose and then move to the folks from the Burnsville School District to talk about why this bill is so important for our students in the state.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. And Mr. Mose, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Matthew Mose, and I'm the Acting Chief Accountability Officer for the St. Paul Public Schools. I'm here today to testify on behalf of HF 2751. And as St. Paul works to meet the academic challenges presented by the grad policy, the district is facing a number of challenges from the logistics of administering these tests to the numbers of students that we need to in each of the windows that are open to us. While we have been able to meet these challenges every month up to this point, it has not been easy, and it has come at a cost. It has come at the cost of access to computer labs in every one of our high schools for up to almost 2 weeks a month. This has forced schools to scrape together lesser alternatives to provide access to technology to enhance learning or to forego this access entirely. In the 21st century, this is not a desirable choice, and it does raise important questions of equity. It has come at the cost of our district having to add additional computers and network capacity to ensure that the machines are operating properly to administer the tests. It has increased the requirements for tech support at our high schools so that we have people trained in the administration and oversight of the testing in each one of our high schools, which is drawing resources away from other things that the school might have invested in otherwise. In St. Paul Public Schools, over 20% of our computers are 7 years or older. Our best case scenario foresees $25 million deficits going into the near future for our district. And so it's difficult to see how we're going to be able to invest the amounts of money that we'll need to get our technology upgraded on a refresh cycle that will accommodate the computer-based testing in a meaningful way. We've been able, as I said before, we've been able to meet these obligations to date, but it is getting increasingly challenging. The paper-pencil administration of the grad may also provide some benefits to a select group of students whom St. Paul serves more than any other district in the state. For our English language learners, the administration of the test via computer adds another variable to the mix, that computer literacy beyond the subject mastery that's being assessed. Anecdotally, we have encountered some situations where some of our students are struggling.
Excuse me, Mr. Mose, I've had a communication from a legislator that's sitting towards the audience and she cannot hear. So if people could please be very quiet so legislators and others around you can hear. Thank you, Mr. Mose.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Anecdotally, we have encountered some situations where some of our students have struggled with the computers, which is adding additional stress to what is now already a very stressful situation for some of our students. We recognize that this proposal likely carries with it an additional cost for the state to provide ongoing paper-pencil administrations, but the computer administration imposes real costs on our districts. St. Paul is interested in having at least some access to paper-pencil tests for students until it is clear that the computer-based testing does not produce different results for specific groups of students. I know at the testimony that the hearing we had in the policy committee that there was talk about the comparability study that the department had done, and while overall it looks like generally the tests are comparable, the computer tests are comparable to the paper-pencil test, it's not that clear for ELL. And while the department's been able to approve the computer-based test as being comparable, it's when you look at the study, it looks like 32% of ELLs pass the paper version and 18% pass the computer-based test. While that may not be statistically significant, it seems like it's significant to the number of kids, the difference between 18 and 32%. Computer-based testing for the grad is our present and possibly the future for all statewide testing. It has a lot of potential benefits if the infrastructure is in place to support the system. As the state moves forward, we want to make sure that the computer testing requirements do not further limit the access to technology and other educational resources. We want to make sure that computer testing is equivalent to paper-pencil administration so that every student has an equal chance to succeed on the state's tests.
Thank you. We have two questions from legislators, and then we'll go on to the next testifier. Representative Ward, and then Representative Detmer. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I can wait for this. Are you done, Mr. Mose?
I am finished, yes.
Okay. My question is about the fiscal note. Can I ask that now, Madam Chair?
Representative Ward, I think we'll stick with questions of this testifier and get in all the testimony, and then I will go right to you after that. Representative Detmer, is yours on the bill or this testifier?
The testifier, ma'am.
Representative Detmer.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Why just the reading test? Why not the math test in terms of the computer versus the paper test?
Mr. Mose or Mr. Mose.
Okay. Madam Chair and representative members of the committee, the focus has been on the reading test at this point because of the changes that the legislature made last year around the grad test and the consequences for individual students. Certainly going forward, we would be concerned about the ability of students to perform equally on any subject. I think the computer literacy piece adds that variable to any test, regardless of the subject. Our focus has been on reading, and when you are talking about our English language learners, the reading test has actually been our biggest hurdle with the students. And so that's, from our district's perspective, been the area where we've been most concerned.
Okay. And then Morgan, next testifier.
Madam Chair, yes, I'd like to bring up two folks from my home school district, Dr. Randy Clegg and Mr. Bruce Morissette. Dr. Clegg is the superintendent of schools in Burnsville, and Mr. Morissette is the associate principal who is in charge of all this testing at our high school.
Thank you. And whichever one is going first, please introduce yourself. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Randy Clegg. I'm superintendent of the Burnsville Egan Savage School District. This afternoon, I'd like to just make a few comments, particularly from a curricular aspect in terms of concerns that we have about the current computerized version of the grad reading test. By changing from a paper pencil to a computerized assessment changes the testing conditions significantly for our students, particularly when current high school students in the state of Minnesota have not received explicit instruction on how to read text online. If you review the state's language arts standards, at fifth grade, there's explicit direction that students will write using a keyboarding. In seventh grade, there's explicit direction that students will start accessing media, such as broadcast, radio, and so forth. It isn't until the high school that it talks about students accessing online resources, but nowhere in the comprehension strategies is there any reference to students reading text online. If you're like me, when I have a complicated piece of reading, such as one of your bills, I usually print it out because you're highlighting, you're underlining, you're writing notes. Reading comprehension online is a more complex skill. When scrolling up and down on a screen causes students to have to use different strategies. Strategies that are not embedded in the state language arts standards, and many of our students have not received explicit instruction. Most of the state language arts standards talks about classical texts and students reading texts, and that's throughout, T-E-X-T, very explicit. Another concern I have is the biases that a online testing situation creates for low-income students. As a district that is undergoing rapid demographic changes, not only socioeconomic makeup of our students, but also the ethnic and racial makeup of our students, we are now becoming very cognizant that not all of our students have ready access to the internet or computerized resources at home beyond the school. We have parts of our community that have absolutely no internet access at all, unless you use the wireless G3 system, which many of them can't afford. So when you start having online assessments for students who don't have the opportunity to practice at home reading online frequently, they are going to be put at a great disadvantage. At this time, I'd like to turn the rest of my time over to Bruce Morissette. He's our associate principal at Burnsville High School, and he has lived and breathed this assessment process for the last 2 years. So, Bruce.
Thank you, Superintendent Clegg, and welcome, Mr. Morissette.
Thank you very much. Yes, unfortunately, I am the reason you are here.
If you could just say your name.
Bruce Morissette. Thank you. I am the reason you are here. And I'm going to talk, you've heard more of the statistic side of it. I'm going to talk more the actual living this. A year ago, I probably would not have even wanted to bring this forward. However, dealing with the students that I deal with over and over again who are coming in to take the reading test, I wish you could see their faces as they walk into the room as I'm sitting there to walk up to a computer, knowing that they're just going to have to try to do this again on the computer with very little sense of hope. Parents who at this point in time are at their wits' end of what they're going to do with their child. These are not students who will not be successful once they leave high school. Many of them, most of them, will. They can't get past this reading test for several reasons. We have done a paper pencil version. It had a pass rate pretty close to a computer version during that same time frame. However, I don't know that those students that passed the test when they took it written would ever have passed it via the computer. For those four students, I gave it the 13 students, I think three or four of them passed it. That was the happiest day that they have had in their high school career. Anytime when the testing is done, students will come running down to my office trying to find out if they passed or not. Many of them leave in tears. Or many of them don't want to see me when I say, how did you do? I only go to those that I think passed, so I don't really discourage them. They get the letter in the mail that from Alice Segrin and also from me saying, I'm sorry, you didn't pass. Guess what? In another 6 weeks, you can come back into the computer lab, and we'll try to do it the exact same way that hasn't worked for you now. Statistics show 13% of our seniors have not passed the reading test at this point in time. I'm happy to say our statistics look like we have about 5% of our seniors that have not passed it. That's still a significant number if you're the parent of one of those students who has not passed. It's heartbreaking. The proposal is
to move up the amount, the timeline to allow the students to take a paper pencil test. And I want to thank Dirk Mattson from the department because he and I have worked on this. Currently, they'd have to go through the test three times before you can really give them a chance to do that. In their junior year, you can't really do that because the next time when it feasibly could happen is right about the time they're going to be getting ready to take the MCA math test. And one of the reasons why we're not so concerned right now about the math test is, as it stands right now, the math test is not one that they have to meet the proficiency that they do on the reading test. This is important. It's become a passion of mine because, I've taken these students on. I see them all the time. I see the dejected look when they walk in every time because they haven't passed it. I saw the faces of those that had the opportunity to do it in a different format, which is paper pencil, and they were pretty excited and pretty happy about it. As my colleague from St. Paul has mentioned, ELL students have a more difficult time doing this on the computer. Comprehending material on a computer screen when you're scrolling up and down or even side to side and then coming up to an answer is difficult. Most of us, as Dr. Clegg has stated, if we have an important piece of material we have to know, we print it off, we mark it up. Currently, there is no more important piece of reading in a high school student's career than this reading test. And we limit the way and the amount of time they can take it in another format. We talk about differentiated learning all the time to meet the goals and the gaps of our students in our high schools, yet we can't differentiate a high-stakes test for these students who over and over again demonstrate they cannot do it in the way that we are presenting it. And to me, it just boggles my mind as an education person and as a state that we really are going to squabble over some money. There's going to be money to it. We have to pay $45 per administration of the paper pencil test. And, we're not getting a lot of money. We're not going to run down the street to find every kid we can to drag him into the room when it's costing us $45 per test. They'll talk about having to monitor and manage.
Martha, I need you to conclude very soon because I have to see if there's testimony. Legislators have questions, and we've got two more hearings. We won't get to Representative Morgan's other bill if we take all his time on this one.
I guess that's probably it. You've heard the statistics. You've heard it actually from a practitioner that is working with the students every time they take the test, and I appreciate your time on this bill.
Thank you, and we appreciate your obvious passion for students. Before I go to the two legislators, raise your hand if you want to testify on the bill. Okay, we have one person. We'll take the two legislators, and we'll have Mr. Mattson, and then we'll try to wrap up. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I particularly want to thank both of the gentlemen from Burnsville Schools for your testimony. It validates what I've experienced as a classroom teacher. I am a language arts teacher. I teach everything from AP 12 literature and composition to a team-taught 10th grade English class. And I know the struggles of the high-stakes test and the effect it has, particularly on our lower performing students. And I can only speak anecdotally from my years of experience teaching writing in the classroom and also reading. But the skills that you talked about, reading up and down on the computer versus from left to right, are very indicative of the problem with not having access routinely to a computer. In my school of 2,000 students, we may have a computer for 40 minutes, a half of a four-period day class period, because there's so much demand to use the computer lab. I cannot teach the students those strategies in order to look at a text. I take a lot of the AP skills that I teach my seniors on how to break up writing. We call it chunking it, looking for textual evidence. But then with my lower skilled students, I give them markers and I have them underline and look for evidence using more simple language to describe what their skills are. I think that we are doing a disservice to tactile learners because it is a hands-on experience for them to be able to do tactile kind of work. I also know that somewhere between the ages of 13 and 17 or 18, students move from being concrete thinkers to abstract thinkers. And it happens at different rates for different kids. And I think the written test really accommodates those differences in learning style. And I really am a strong supporter of what you're trying to do here, simply because my experience in the classroom has told me that this is the correct way to test students who are struggling.
Thank you. Our testimony from people who actually have to look kids in the eye, I think, is very important. Representative Ward has the next question. It's on the fiscal note. So, Representative Ward, would it be all right if we brought up Dr. Mattson, who's the contact person from the agency, on the fiscal note, or did you want to ask Mr. Strom or Mr.
Fine.
Crow?
That's fine.
Mr. Mattson. Okay, Dr. Mattson, if you could give us your testimony, and then we'll have Representative Ward ask his question of you. Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, good afternoon. My name is Dirk Mattson. I'm the Director of Research and Assessment for the Minnesota Department of Education. As we spoke in House policy, the Department continues to have strong reservations about this bill. You've heard numerous testimony. As a recovering English teacher myself, I will say that I have also instructed in those skills and so forth. So I not only come to this as the numbers guy and testing, but also as a classroom teacher. As we noted, as has been noted, we have done numerous comparability studies. We are required to do those comparability studies to demonstrate that the test is able to bring about the same inferences, results from paper versus computer. That said, we also recognize that a small amount of students will have a preference to participate on paper. And so this is a practice that is actually available now. We do have a paper form. We do ask that it be paid for by the school, because this is not a part of our testing contract. We established the testing contract based on the law that is passed at the time, and we roll up that contract and to continue it forward. So this is an activity that has not been costed out. As Mr. Morissette stated, we do have a number of students who have tried on this paper version. We have a very small number of students who have passed on that paper version. Statistically, it is insignificant to be looking at their scores to be able to tell whether it was because they took it on paper or because they simply took it another time that they passed. You can't attribute that passing score to paper. We do have the markup tools that are available. We do have practice tests that are available. We have worked thoroughly with Minnesota teachers to identify how the test should be formatted, how it should look, so forth. I'll also state that we have been having conversations with St. Paul recently. We do plan this spring to open up the regular Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments 10th grade test to any junior or senior that has not passed that test yet. And that test actually has two tests embedded in one. So they will have a paper opportunity. That is our plan. We will charge the same amount that a non-public student gets, which is about $6.50, and that will go toward the same process we've done before. So that is our plan, to open up that test for a non-passing junior or senior, and they will have essentially two bites at the apple in one sitting, as their 10th grade counterparts do. So we have worked very diligently, not only in establishing the policy with Mr. Morissette, which we piloted with him and worked very thoroughly to establish, but also continue to work to try and find the best opportunities for students. And I'll stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did want to say to Dr. Clay and Mr. Morissette that you really hit home for me, and Representative Swales as well, you hit home for me on student learning styles and the different, you know, the different styles that we always in education talk about, but when we come to a certain situation, we go back to one tunnel vision kind of thing. Dr. Mattson, you mentioned practice tests. Can you tell me what kind of form the practice tests come in?
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, the practice tests, just as in our paper tests, are made to mirror the format of the actual administration. So in a computer administration, they mirror that administration. They have split screens so the student can look at the passage and the question at the same time, all the tools that are available during administration.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So they are only computerized?
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, that's correct.
Representative Ward.
Let me ask you another question about just the number that you came up with in the fiscal note. The number that the department used was 10,000 students taking that exam. Is the fiscal note that I'm looking at. I'm assuming it's the same fiscal note that everybody has. How did you come up with that number? How did the department come up with that number of 10,000 students?
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, we looked at the current non-pass rate that we have right now of seniors, which has identified has been about 13%. We anticipate by the time this bill were put into place and practice that we would have additional students that would take this. That gives you roughly about 8,500 students of current, and then to add in roughly another 1,500 students. We do not know, the bill is not specific to which students can test, so we have to assume that all students at least would have access to that test. So it's hard for me to say one-fifth versus two-fifths of that population would test.
And then, thank you, Madam Chair. So if I heard you correctly, that you looked at the history of the test, which has about a 13% failure rate, and that was approximately 8,500 students in Minnesota, and then added 1,500 because you're not sure how many were going to be additional to that, if that's what I heard correctly, to come up with 10,000. Mr. Mattson, is a 13% failure rate, do you think that would be indicative year after year after year after year?
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, I would hope not, because I would hope the performance of students would continue to increase.
So then that 10,000, sorry, Madam Chair, so that 10,000 number may decrease in also, correct?
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, that is a possibility, yes.
Okay.
Representative Ward.
Thank you. That answers my questions as of now.
Okay, very good. We're going to, members, take about 5 more minutes for this bill and then have closing comments with Representative Ward, because I'm trying to give half an hour to each bill, and I was a little bit late, so we'll take a couple more minutes here, but I want to get on to the next bill at about 20 after. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Morgan, is it possible to take an exam with the paper copy and then put your answers on computer for a student that has problems with the computer version? Is it possible to do that?
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, actually, that is the process we use now, because when we do use the paper version, because the tests are actually spiraled individual, or they're assigned at the student level, because students can enter into any one of these administrations at any time. So we track which form the student has taken, and that's how we're able to process it and get the results back in the same time frame if they had taken it on computer.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Biscuits.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, to you, I haven't seen the numbers, so I'm not sure if you've gotten a target yet. I know I've asked Representative Carlson quite often if he's given targets, so I'm not sure if you've gotten one or not, but I highly doubt that your target is on the positive side when we're looking at eliminating...
Representative Biscuits, we're still haggling over that. You can imagine.
I do appreciate that. But, Madam Chair, you know, when we come to the statewide testing and standard setting, et cetera, and we look at the data, and I'm not sure that this has improved learning at all, and we've got many years of data. And I know from a lot of circles I run, this may be blasphemy, but, you know, I wonder if it isn't time to start looking at whether statewide testing is something we should be investing money in at all. And if we could do our small part, it would be to eliminate statewide testing as our share of helping the state's ongoing budget problems, and then trust the school districts to set high standards and hold their graduates to those high standards. You know, it's a recurring theme that I have, Madam Chair, but it is a theme of trust, and trust the local elected officials.
Representative Biscuits, there's so often that you and I come from different angles and come out with the same conclusion. It's kind of scary. Representative Garofalo, you have like one more minute, and we're going to have to cut this off. Representative Garofalo.
I disagree with Representative Biscuits, but no, it's okay. The Representative Morgan, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, mm-hmm. Are you going to be requesting a new fiscal note on this, given the policy change in this, so we can... obviously there's still a cost. It's different. But.
Yeah. Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, Representative Graffalo, absolutely. I would not suggest moving forward with this until we get a fiscal note on the new on the amendment.
Okay, and Madam Chair and members of the committee, I just I know that personal experience is not a good way to direct public policy, but just so people are aware, in my private sector job, I am a CCNA, a Cisco Certified Network Associate. Virtually every technical certification that's given on the planet right now, none of them are paper and pencil. They're all computer-based. You don't have a choice. It's a matter of information security and integrity of the testing. So while I appreciate that different people may learn in different ways, this is a skill that students should be encouraged to learn and adapt to rather than adapting the testing mechanism that they're learning from. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Morgan, closing comment.
Very quickly, Madam Chair. There are costs to high-stakes testing, as Representative Biskins pointed out. No doubt about it. There are costs of developing the test, of administering the test, of scoring the test. There are also costs of students not graduating. And these are significant long-term financial costs to our society, to our state. I think education, I don't think it is. Education is a property right. And we ought to make darn sure we are taking all reasonable steps to ensure students have an opportunity to prove what they know in a way that works for them. So I think this is a reasonable step to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. And House File 2751 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Papp. Did you ask anyone to move your bill, or should I move your bill for you? Okay, I'll move House File 2880 for possible inclusion. And Representative Kath also has an amendment. Representative Kath, do you want to talk about the bill or do the amendment first?
I'd like to do the amendment, and then I have an oral addition to that amendment as well, if that's okay, Madam
I'll
Chair.
Move, amendment A1, and Representative Kath, the oral addition
is on page 4.
Page 4 of the bill. We'll do the amendment first, then.
Sounds good.
Okay. Do you want to explain the amendment?
The amendment is after talking to the Department of Education, coming up with some language that they would be more amenable to and how it would fit to shrink the fiscal note.
Very good. Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Garofalo.
Just really quick. This isn't your first time before the committee, is it?
No, it is not.
Thank you,
Representative Garofalo. Thank you for that.
Otherwise, we wanted Girl Scout cookies, right, Representative Garofalo? Representative Graffalo is a good helper of his daughter, the Girl Scout. All right. If there isn't any other discussion, all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And Representative Kath, your oral amendment.
Oral amendment is on page 4, Madam Chair, line 4.16. And it is to put it into the same language as it is for other grade levels when it comes to retesting. On page 4.16, strike the words a minimum of and change that to up to.
Representative Kath, I'll move for Representative Kath, his oral amendment on line 4.16, strike a minimum of and insert up to. Any discussion? All in favor say aye. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails, and that amendment is adopted. Representative Kath, to your bill.
The bill itself is a joint effort by myself and Senator Koch. We had representatives from my district as well as a principal from her district who came before us saying that once we get into that senior year, and specifically in the area of the reading test, making sure that we offer as many opportunities to our local school districts as possible to give their kids testing opportunities. And what occurs now is that it's every 2 months, every other month, a testing opportunity is offered with also having 6 weeks of remediation. What we're hoping to do is give those students as many testing opportunities as possible with the flexibility of their school district. For instance, in my district, our remediation is actually a course that the student is enrolled in during the school day. We offer a 4-period day, and within that that remediation time, we would like to make sure the student has a testing opportunity. But it all depends on when that course is offered, then when the test is offered, and there can be lag times of up to 2 to 4 weeks before a student will be able to take that test. What we're trying to do is say that during the senior year that we need to give those students as many opportunities as possible. So what this does then is put it more on a 4-week track so that districts then can help those students remediate so that they can get this test mastered before they graduate.
specifically as well, too, are just the anecdotal situations that many students are not only trying to pass a test, they're also trying to stay on track with credits and other issues before them for graduation, and this is just trying to give as many opportunities for our local districts as possible to help those students reach success, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Taft. Any questions? Representative Newton.
Madam Chair, I see it's a 12th grade student, a 12th grade test, but it's being taken right at the beginning of the of 12th grade. So why don't we administer this test at the end of 11th grade and then let the student have the opportunity to take a remedial course during the summer and retake the test?
Representative Taft.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, that is a good point, and it is actually already in place that if a student has not mastered that test yet, they do have currently in the 11th grade year as well as the summer opportunities. And having talked to Dr. Mattson, if he'd like to come down and discuss any of the stipulations here with this, what we agreed to then is saying that during the senior year is when the time crunch actually starts coming in place. So that's why we put the October date, saying that then it could be every 4 weeks, so then they would give as many testing opportunities before the actual date of graduation. But you're absolutely right that they are afforded opportunities every other month when they are an 11th grader, as well as through that summer.
Representative Newton, would you also like to hear from Dr. Mattson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would. Because it just strikes me that what would happen is with a student who hasn't passed the test that you're going to have four weeks of remediation. You know what I mean? They're starting in September, and that's all you're going to be doing up until the time of the test. So I would prefer to use the summer period if that's possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, maybe I can help a little bit. Remember, this test is first given in the spring of 10th grade. And so current Minnesota rule that was adopted last year or sometime thereabouts says that a student we do administer this test. Districts may administer it every month. And the student, however, Minnesota rule currently says that the student needs up to 6 weeks for remediation before they may retake. So essentially what that is every other month after that April administration, starting in June of that year, their 10th grade year, just as they're leaving the door, they may participate in a retest. And then every other month they can do that throughout their sophomore, the summer that comes following 10th grade, throughout their 11th grade year, throughout the summer that comes after 11th grade, and the language that's now been adopted here just says once they reach their senior year, that every other month stipulation starting in October can be more frequent. It doesn't have to be every other month. It becomes every month starting with October.
Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm more confused than I was before. Is there anything preventing them from doing this now if they choose to?
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, yes. Current Minnesota rule says that a student may retest no more frequently than they must have at least 6 weeks for remediation. They cannot take it more frequently than 6 weeks. And because we have a window that's at the beginning of every month, that de facto becomes 8 weeks.
All right. I don't see any other legislators on the list. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill? We could have had longer on the other bill, I guess.
We'll have longer on this one.
Yeah, we will. Okay. All right. Well, then, closing statement from Representative Kapp.
Well, Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the time to be here. And as I like to consider myself a bridge builder, I think the new language fits well. I'm glad that the department was able to work with me on this, and I look forward to giving more opportunities to our students.
Thank you very much. And with that, renew the motion that House File 2880 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much. Representative Morgan. And members, Representative Morgan does have an author's amendment in the packet, and for today he has decided not to author it. So you can just disregard his amendment, the A1 amendment.
A lot of help.
All right.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I would like to move House File 3120. 23 for possible fossil inclusion in the omnibus bill, I think is what we're saying right now.
House File 3123 for possible inclusion. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as you mentioned, there's at least one amendment in your packet. This is an extremely complex topic. The topic of third-party billing for special education services in schools. It's something I had a vague familiarity with in my experience as a teacher, and I have slightly less vague familiarity with it now, which is why I have with me today three experts in the area who are going to focus not so much on the bill you have before you or the amendment in your packet, because to be honest with you, we are still working on this with the Department of Human Services to come up with some language that really works and accomplishes what we want to do. But they're at least going to explain a little background on what third-party billing is, why it's important to school districts, and how this bill, or how our goal is to help address some of these challenges, even though the bill as written may not quite do that yet. So if that hasn't confused you all, I apologize. But here are my testifiers, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
All right. And so whoever's going to go first, if you could introduce yourself.
I can do that. My name is Bob Bodlin. I'm Assistant Superintendent, Director of Special Education for the Bemidji Area Schools.
My name is Kay Dole, and I'm with Minneapolis Public Schools, and I coordinate our third-party billing project there, and I'm also the co-chair of the statewide network leadership group for third-party billing.
My name is Janet Long, and I've been the coordinator for third-party reimbursement in St. Paul Public Schools for the last 10 years.
Okay, and who is going to start?
I'm going to start.
Okay, Mr. Vadelin.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dreiling, and members of the committee. Minnesota has a long history of accomplishment providing health care services to special education students. The Department of Education and the Department of Human Services have worked together to support reimbursing school districts across the state with federal funds available through medical assistance. However, Minnesota can do better. We believe costly and burdensome procedures are limiting our ability to access full reimbursement for the services we provide. In short, Minnesota is leaving federal medical assistance money on the table in a time of severe fiscal distress. The recommendations advanced in this bill streamline the process and procedure to seek reimbursement from the federal government and reduce administrative costs to districts. This can be accomplished with no loss or limit to the service we provide to students with disabilities. This legislation makes the federal medical assistance reimbursement process more efficient, so we are fully reimbursed for the actual services we provide. From 2004 to 2009, Minnesota school districts received federal medical assistance dollars totaling $116,062,928.93. In 2009, Minnesota schools received $25,421,774. However, settle up on this revenue has not been done. This is significantly less than the cost of health care services delivered by school districts to Minnesota's children in special education. This results in education being the payer of first resort for IEP health-related services, even though Section 1905.42 USC 1396B allows medical assistance to pay for these services. We have identified barriers that, if removed, would result in an estimated 25% to 40% increase in the revenue that Minnesota school districts may receive for health care services that are already being provided to Minnesota's special education students. This is lost revenue that could be made available to Minnesota school districts. I'm going to let the other two people here at this point go on and talk about consents, third-party liability, and settle up rates.
Ms. Lowe.
Okay. And I'm Kay Dole.
Oh, it's going to be Ms. Dole. Okay.
All right. And I'm going to just be addressing the issue of consents, as this is one of the areas that we see as a great barrier to accessing the full amount of these dollars. First of all, school districts are required to obtain parental consent to disclose information necessary for coverage and payment. MS-125A.21 Subdivision 7. In addition, parents must sign the consent for provision of health-related services that are included in the IEP or the Individual Education Plan. in the students' special education program, and also they signed the medical assistance application form. This process is burdensome and time-consuming, and our current information is reportedly showing that in some districts, 25 to 40% of eligible students do not have parental consent. This results in a significant loss of revenue for our school districts. Our recommendation is that DHS add language to the medical assistance application that would allow for consent for release of records for IEP health-related services for payment. Thank you.
Okay, and now Ms. Lowe.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to address something called third-party liability, and I don't know if you've ever heard of it before, but you probably have with your insurance policies. Essentially, what it means is if a child, a student, has a combination of medical assistance and private insurance, school districts must follow federal and state laws and regulations regarding third-party liability, which means we must contact the private insurance company to determine if IEP health-related services are covered in schools. And just so you understand what IEP health-related services mean, it's like occupational therapy, physical therapy, nursing, paraprofessional services, social work services, and speech services, and school psych as well. And this process is very burdensome because we have to send a letter to the private insurance company, and if they don't respond, and a lot of times they don't respond because they don't understand why schools are sending them information about coverage of health services, so then we have to send another letter, and if they don't respond, then we still send them another letter, and we track this system kind of throughout the year, and it almost takes kind of all year to determine and get these denial letters back. This process is very complex and takes a lot of tracking, and to date, our district since 2001 has had 760 denials from private insurance companies that they do not pay for IEP health-related services in school, with no private insurance companies have paid to date. So many districts in the state of Minnesota just have decided not to do this process because they don't have the time or manpower to follow and do this process. So what's in this bill is, what we propose in this bill is, we know that through federal legislation, states can request a waiver for these services if it's not cost effective. And what we're asking DHS to do is ask for this waiver. Requesting this waiver would also help make it easier for rural and suburban areas in third-party billing, because they probably have higher percentages of students with a combination of private insurance and medical assistance versus urban areas that have more concentrated areas of students with only medical assistance. This waiver would also take, and I think this would be a really plus for this bill, it would take the fear away from parents about signing consent for third-party billing, because in this day and age, they do not want to sign any form that they think would jeopardize their private health care insurance, and understandably so. If you're a parent with a child with a disability who has very complex health issues, you're in no way going to be inclined to sign that insurance form. Currently, we have 1,200 students without consent in our district that we're still working on, and of those 1,200, 266 of those students have third-party liability, meaning a combination of medical assistance and private insurance, where we would have to track this throughout the whole year. So again, the proposal would eliminate a lot of the administrative burdens of the third-party liability.
Okay, Mr. Van Vliet.
I can talk about the third part, the settle up and rates. Settle up process is a lengthy, greater than 2 year in most services. It's an involved and complex process. School districts' inability to use the revenue is affected by this process because it prolongs the time that the districts are able to get that revenue in and get it accessible. The rate setting methodology currently has flaws related to electronic data reporting system, EDRS, and this may further be complicated by the plan to change from EDRS reporting to the state and educational record view and submission system, which is a brand new SERV system that we're presently using in school settings. Some states are moving to other methods for settle up, and Minnesota should explore other options to determine what is best for Minnesota. School districts are being held liable for audit findings presently resulting in paybacks, even when districts have accurately and correctly followed the guidelines in the individualized health-related services technical assistance guide and electronic data reporting system and instructions through the Minnesota Department of Education. And lastly, districts are only allowed to contest rates for 60 days, yet DHS is requesting districts to go back to 2001 for data to disallow some of those same revenues. I do have just a few more things to say about the settle-up rates. Although I've worked in public schools for an entire career, my familiarity with third-party reimbursements has been limited until recently. Recent experiences, however, have created a learning curve that entails dealing with the number of third-party billing issues, with settle-up rates and Minnesota rules for settle-up being a major concern. I have been invited today to speak very succinctly about the timelines of rate setting and how the process and rules affected the Bemidji area schools in particular. We understand that the process of rate setting is a cumbersome phenomenon that needs to be conducted by DHS in order to make appropriate reimbursement payments to school districts. We appreciate the effort put into creating an equitable system. However, the rules need to work for schools the same as they do for state agency. At this time, there's a double standard being followed where DHS can implement changes in settle-up rates at any time for the agency's benefit and go back up to 3 years or more to make corrections and collections. Yet for school districts such as ours, we requested an appeal for an error that was found to have been made only 2 years prior to the time it was appealed, and yet it was denied. Our journey over the past 20 months has taken us from a point of being advised that there may be a problem with our settle-up data from 05-06 and an internal audit that confirmed the problem for which $98,448 was withheld in payments from DHS. To the district making a formal appeal to get a settle-up rate adjusted, to being denied the adjustment by DHS, to a formal hearing in front of an administrative law judge as initiated by the district, to the ALJ finding that the district should be paid in full, to a subsequent denial from the state agency to not allow the ALJ's findings, and ultimately to a present status of uncertainty as to the district will be paid the amount that has been withheld or not. In addition, the ALJ also determined that the administrative rules which are in place and being followed for the purpose of administering the medical assistance program pursuant to subsection 256B.04 subdivision 2 are binding only to county agencies. The ALJ went on to state in its conclusions of law that the department's application of the rule to the district, which is not a county agency, is directly in conflict with the purpose of that section. Further, the ALJ stated the department's application of the rule to the district is therefore invalid and the department cannot hold the rule against the district. Our questions are twofold. The first question, what does it take to make it known that there needs to be a change in the process of rate setting, including the establishment of equitable timelines for school districts to make appeals, which are consistent with the timelines that DHS can implement when an error is detected? Secondly, if the present rules which are in effect for our county agencies as per the ALJ's conclusion of law, then how can DHS continue to withhold payments to school districts such as ours when in fact the rules don't apply to the payments to school districts at all? As one can see, any new statutory language needs to address these two issues very clearly to eliminate any chance of misinterpretation of the law, which results in critical payments being withheld from school districts that are desperately needed in a timely manner. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, I wish I could tell you right now that the DE2 amendment you have in your packets is exactly what we need. I want to thank Mr. Strom for working so hard with DHS on developing not only the bill, but the First Amendment and then the Second Amendment.
And Representative Morgan, they don't have the
DE2. Oh, they don't have the DE2.
As long
okay.
as you weren't offering it that one, they didn't.
We're holding that back. Okay, yeah. Great. It may, in effect, it may actually be what we want to do with this bill. But right now, there are still some questions about it. Folks are still looking it over. We want to get it right. We want to address these issues. Let me kind of summarize in my layperson's terms what I've gotten out of this over the last 3 or 4 weeks of working on it. Currently, school districts are paying for health care that they provide for students when their health care providers or Medicaid or Minnesota Care should be doing that. These costs are contributing to the special education cross-subsidy that we all know very well. And they are taking dollars out of other services, programs, and classroom money that we can spend on our students' education. If we can fix these issues appropriately, we think it's a wonderful idea. These are tight times for schools. Anything we can do to help them, I think, in a responsible way is a good idea. This is not going to solve all their problems. This is really couch cushion change kind of stuff, but for some school districts, it's a big couch cushion, and I think it's a responsible way to move forward to help fix this problem, and Madam Chair, with your support, as soon as we do have the actual solution that everybody is on board with, we'd like to come back, spend a few more minutes not talking about the background again, but talking exactly about what the solution would do, get that onto the bill, and move from there.
Thank you, Representative Morgan, and that is exactly what we intend to do, because I think this is a very good bill. In fact, members, anybody who hasn't signed on, this may be the only chance in town to have any new money, couch cushions or not, money is money, this year. And so Representative Biskins probably wants to get on this bill, and anyone else. And I might note as well that the fiscal note makes up for the fiscal note on Representative Morgan's first bill. There is no fiscal note, but new money for schools. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll take your advice to heart. But I do have a question, particularly as it concerns EDRS and the move to serves. As I look at the handout under settle up and rates, I look at your third arrow, and your third arrow states that there is flaws with EDRS. And as a person who has worked with that quite closely the last 2 years, I would concur with that statement. However, I'm skeptical of your second part of that statement, which says, and this may further be complicated by the plan to change from EDRS to serves. My understanding is this change from EDRS to serves is to consolidate information in a broad, so that there is better information sharing and there is more timely response amongst the different departments and agencies. So I'm wondering if this bill isn't putting the cart before the horse, as the case may be, and we shouldn't allow some time for serves to become fully implemented to see if that doesn't indeed fix the problem that's out there.
Mr. Vondelen.
I'm going to defer that
to Ms. Lowe.
Madam Chair, Representative
Biskins.
What we heard from Department of Human Services not too long ago, probably last week or the week before, is that they have not heard anything about serves and have from the Minnesota Department of Education and have some concerns about that. And we have concerns about that as well, because we don't want it to come back and haunt us. What we do know, both Kay and I, is coming from, we've been at some national conferences and have followed what some other states are doing for settle up. And settle up, CMS is recommending, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid is recommending settle up be done in different ways. And some states are doing it through time studies, and some states through intergovernmental transfers. And, you know, from what I've heard, a state really doesn't want to look at other methods of doing things. But I agree with you, there are some definite flaws in the EDRS system. It was not set up for medical assistance rates, obviously. Bob, you know that it was set up for special education expenditures, and there's been some real flaws in the system. So we have real concerns about the medical assistance rates and using that system for that, and would like to be proactive to prevent errors. Thank you very much, Kay.
Any questions from any other questions from members? Any testimony from the audience? And I don't see anyone here, but Reps. And Morgan, could you mention your work with some of the advocates for the people that are in special education, their children, and so forth?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you very much. Sue Abderholden with NAMI and Kim Kang with PACER have both taken a look at the bill. And Kim Kang was in our conversation as we were looking over the amendments to the bill. So they are supportive of the efforts. They are looking forward to taking a look at the language as it is now and making certain that it does the things that we want it to do. They think that we're moving in the right direction.
Thank you very much. Rep. Sam Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for the testifiers, I believe. My wife is a speech therapist and who is involved in third-party billing, has her C's and all, and that is all of the stuff. So I understand it a little bit. And I know how important it is to school districts, number one, as you talked about the couch cushion. It can be significant, very much so. I was just talking to her on the phone the other night, 2 nights ago I think it was, and she had gotten an action alert from MSHA as a concern of some proposal in the state that was going to impact third-party billing with speech and language, with OT, with PT. Can you address that? And I can't remember exactly... I wasn't listening to her very hard, so that was my problem. But don't tell her I said that. But it was an action alert from MSHA, which she rarely gets action alerts from MSHA. From ASHA she does, but not from MSHA. So is there something going on there with third party billing,
Ms. Doyle?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Ward. The issue, as I understand it, that people are very concerned about now is what may happen with the governor's proposal to remove occupational therapy, physical therapy, and speech and language therapy from being reimbursed for those people on medical assistance above age 21. And the language does not at this time include children. However, that is certainly of concern to us, because should that happen in the future, that would essentially, in our estimation, eliminate this whole program. So obviously it's of great concern, and we would hate to see that happen. This revenue is very significant for school districts. It's used for many purposes, to provide equipment, to provide staffing, to provide all kinds of needs for our special ed students, and we would hate to see it go away.
Rep. Ward.
Thank you, and thank you for clarifying that. So now it does make sense to me, and so I agree with you totally, and hopefully that will never happen. So thank you.
Thank you. And we have a new testifier. Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Cecilia Dodge. I'm the Director of Special Education for St. Paul Public Schools. And I'd like to respond briefly to Representative Biskin's question about CERVs and EDRS.
Mm-hmm. Please.
Representative Biskin, just in hearing your question, I wanted to further respond to the to your question about the comment about EDRS and CERVs. My colleague here, Janet Lowe, correctly responded that EDRS itself was not set up to do third-party billing, and we've made it work. When I say we, I used to be in that position at the Department of Education when we set up the third-party billing structure. So I've been with it from the beginning and knew that it was flawed to begin with, because it wasn't set up to be used as that purpose. Now, as the department moves forward towards CERVs, and you're correct that CERVs is designed to consolidate information, UFARs, blah, 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 I'm concerned because CERVs as a system is actually less detailed than EDRS, And the fact that up until 2 weeks ago, our understanding is that there hasn't been communication between MDE and DHS about how CERVs will manage the rate setting is just cause for concern. So that's the point.
Thank you very much. And this bill will somewhere in some form be going to the Health and Human Services Committee. And we've had some form of this law on the books for 10 years, but there's always been just not a matchup of the two cultures of education and health and human services. But now that we are so desperate for money, we just are determined to make this work this year. So thank you all, and to Representative Morgan for bringing this bill forward. Any other testimony? Testimony. Any other questions? Representative Morgan, then.
Thank you much, Madam Chair, for your indulgence in our desires to get it right, and for being patient with us and letting us come back next time with hopefully a good solution that we can move forward with.
Thank you so much, Representative Morgan and others, for working on this. And we will, when you notify us that you're ready, we'll bring it back with plenty of notice for people to look at the amendment.
Right.
And with all of us working together, surely we will get it right. And then we'll lay it over at that time. But for now, we will also lay it House File 3123 over for possible inclusion. Members, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.